Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. French special forces have been deployed in Libya to fight the Islamic State group, according to France's Le Monde reporting Wednesday. It triggered an official probe into a possible leak of classified information. Le Monde says special forces and members of the DGSE External Security Service were present in Libya for clandestine operations against IS jihadists, thought to number several thousand in the country. It also claimed that airstrike in November that killed the top IS leader in the country, Abu Nabil, was initiated by Paris. Meanwhile, French officials said it had launched an investigation into the leak. Opposing groups in South Sudan's peace process have agreed on an arrangement to allow 1,370 opposition forces into the capital of Juba in preparation for rebel leader Riek Machar to join a transitional government. South Sudan's Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission said in a statement Tuesday that police and military officers loyal to the opposition are expected to travel to Juba immediately. More security forces are expected to join them after the power-sharing transitional government is formed. Uganda's main opposition presidential candidate, Dr. Kizza Besigye, said he has asked his lawyers to challenge in a court of law what he called his continued illegal detention by police. Besigye of the Forum of Democratic Change Party said he has been in and out of police detention since last Saturday without being charged. One in five African children do not receive basic life-saving vaccines, according to the World Health Organization report Wednesday. The World Health Organization says that more is needed to prevent the spread of diseases such as measles. This is VOA News. U.S. President Barack Obama is hosting Jordan's King Abdullah II at the White House Wednesday for talks focused on the battle against the Islamic State and the humanitarian fallout from the war in Syria. Jordan has been taking part in the U.S.-led coalition conducting airstrikes against Islamic State targets in both Iraq and Syria. The meeting comes as U.S. and Russia work to convince opposing sides in Syria to participate in a ceasefire starting on Saturday. Afghanistan's Taliban says it's unaware of upcoming peace talks with the Kabul government, reiterating no such move can succeed until foreign forces completely withdraw and Sharia is enforced in the country. Tuesday, a four-nation group working for Afghan peace invited all Taliban and other groups to participate through their authorized representatives in the first round of peace talks with the Afghan government by the first week of March in Pakistan. However, a spokesman for the Taliban's so-called political office in Qatar, Mohammed Naeem, told VOA he has seen media reports about possible peace talks with the Afghan government, but said the insurgent group is unaware of any such plans. Meanwhile, Russia has delivered 10,000 Kalashnikov rifles along with millions of rounds of ammunition to the Afghan government. It's part of a security agreement between the two nations. The rifles were delivered at a ceremony Wednesday at Kabul's military airport. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has confirmed to his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, that Syria is ready to help implement a ceasefire plan to begin on Saturday. The two leaders spoke by telephone on Wednesday and highlighted the importance of continuing to fight terror groups such as the Islamic State and Jabhat al-Nusra. A senior U.S. naval officer in the Pacific warned U.S. lawmakers Tuesday that China is building up its military capability in the contested South China Sea. Admiral Harry Harris testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee.
In my opinion, China is clearly militarizing the South China Sea. And you'd have to believe in a flat earth to think otherwise.
Meanwhile, the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi in Washington for talks with U.S. officials complained that other countries are illegally occupying Chinese reefs and atolls and engaged in large-scale military construction. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say it's investigating 14 new reports of Zika virus infection in the United States, all suspected to be sexually transmitted. The CDC made the announcement Tuesday and said all of the 14 cases are women whose only known risk factor is sexual contact with a male partner who had recently traveled to an area with local Zika transmissions. In a statement, the CDC says a new report suggests that sexual transmission may be more likely. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Higgs Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The turnout is very low. I think has been a setback from the last presidential elections. I'm not even certain if half of the people who voted last time are coming to vote today.
That's an election observer at a polling station for Uganda's municipal elections. Voter turnout was low despite President Yoweri Museveni's urging Ugandans to vote in the election for mayor and local council members. We'll have full details coming up.
Also in the news, teams of U.S. and Brazilian health workers have begun efforts to determine if the Zika virus is causing babies to be born with a birth defect affecting the brain.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Uganda in our daily feature, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Uganda held local elections today, 6 days after a tense presidential poll. President Yoweri Museveni has urged Ugandans to vote in the elections for mayors and local council members. But as Elizabeth Pillow reports from Kampala, turnout was low and a feeling of uncertainty lingers in the capital.
Unlike the presidential election in Kampala, which was marred by late delivery of voting materials and election day unrest, local elections got off to a mostly smooth start Wednesday. At most voting centers, materials arrived within an hour or two of polls opening, and although minor problems have been reported, for the most part, voters say they're happy with the process. However, polling agents note that voter turnout has been very low. Gloria Paga, an observer at one polling station, says people were demoralized by the presidential vote.
The turnout is very low. I think it has been a setback from the last presidential elections. I'm not even certain if half of the people who voted last time are coming to vote today. Last time the queues were very long, but today you can see practically at this time there's no one on the line. So probably people were disappointed with what occurred in the presidential elections, but we are optimistic.
At one station in Nakasero, nearly 600 people were registered to vote, but only 83 had cast their ballot by noon. One Ugandan named Desmond says he feels intimidated by heavy police presence in the area.
The regime is succeeding at controlling the people's anger and the hope. It's holding people's hopes at bay. Ugandans have accepted that this regime maybe sort of is here to stay. I cannot do anything with it, and unless if I come out to say no to a thing or two, everything of mine will be, you know, gone, and the last thing I'll have in my life is to be lured to a grave.
Many within Uganda noted the distinct lack of reaction when President Museveni's victory was announced by the Electoral Commission last Saturday. The usually bustling streets of downtown Kampala were deserted, and many worried violence could erupt. Although protests never took place and city life has returned, residents are still uneasy. Such feelings are compounded by the continued house arrest of main Museveni rival Kizza Besigye, with many Ugandans openly wondering how long he'll be held without charges. Besigye has called his detainment illegal and says officials are keeping him from challenging the election results. However, officials in Uganda contend that Besigye's call for protests at the Electoral Commission amount to plans to disrupt public order. They say he has been put under preventative arrest to keep the peace. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Uganda's main opposition presidential candidate, Dr. Kizza Besigye, says he has asked his lawyers to challenge his continued illegal detention by the police. Besigye of the Opposition Forum for Democratic Change Party, FDC, said he has been in and out of police detention since last Saturday without being charged. He says he has been picked up every morning by police and taken to a police station where he is held until nightfall. Police have been stationed outside Besigye's residence since he vowed to lead a protest march against President Yoweri Museveni's election victory. There have been no signs of protests. Besigye says he and Museveni are still candidates in the 2016 election. Under the Constitution, he says either candidate can challenge the results in court, an option he has not ruled out. The 2016 election was the fourth in which Besigye has challenged Museveni. In each election, election, Besigye went to court to charge vote rigging and lost.
The European Union's biggest hope of stemming the tide of migrants and refugees flooding into Europe depends on a long-term deal with Turkey. Major financial aid offered to Ankara may settle Syrian refugees now in Turkey and welcome thousands more who continue to flee the war in their homeland. VOA's David Arnold reports from Washington, D.C.
Europe still struggles with more than a million migrants and refugees. Europe's migrant crisis may get a lot worse and much sooner than officials think, says Dimitrios Papadimitriou. Papadimitriou is the founder of the Migration Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., and a critic of the way the European Union has managed its population crisis.
If Europe does nothing, the only expectation should be that more people will be coming, and there is no reason for the more people not to be 2 million or perhaps 3 million. If Europe and Greece and Italy do not protect Europe's Mediterranean borders, if the agreement with Turkey does not begin to bear fruit, if all of those things happen, then Europe will be overwhelmed, and we don't have to wait until the end of 16. You can expect this to happen certainly by April or May of this year, and you will actually begin to see governments topple.
Greece has served as the accidental and often tragic doorstep to Europe for most of more than a million refugees. Papadimitriou says the European Union has failed to offer the Greek government the aid it needs to control that migration crisis.
Greece is so responsible for some of the things that have come its way, and it practiced what just about every other country between Greece and Germany has practiced, which is run a turnstile where anybody who comes in can find its way to the desirable places, Germany and Sweden. Greece doesn't have the resources. It has a vast maritime set of borders. And without full cooperation of the rest of Europe, Greece simply cannot control those borders.
Hungary and its neighbors have constructed barbed wire fences to stop the flows into their countries. But Papadimitriou says those efforts are short-sighted and bound to fail.
Suppose that the numbers coming through Greece, as they will, because it's going to be spring and the waters are going to be calmer. I suppose that many more people make it to Greece. So what do we do? Fence it, which is what some people in Brussels and member states are talking about. And if we do that, what will Brussels and the other member states do about a complete revolution and breakdown in law and order in Greece? And after that happens, and people no longer want to make it to Greece, I can guarantee you that, they all are going to go back and do what they were doing 2 years ago, which is get into Italy. Are you going to fence Italy? It's a country of 60 million people, and it has a very large economy. And after you expel Italy out of Schengen, are you going to do the same thing to Spain? This is just the kind of talk and finger-pointing that happens all too easily in Europe.
He says the best hope for the European Union is to commit massive funding to the Turkish government. That funding will pay for several steps to reduce the migrant flow across the Aegean to Greece.
The one that's relatively easy but politically difficult is to basically shut down the smuggling operations. Turkey is a strong state. It has a great administration system. It has, police forces. And now smuggling in Turkey takes place above the ground. So what you need to do is you have to make sure that you attack the smugglers where they hurt. You put them in jail. You take their money away because really, following the money is also a part of this. You make sure that your local officials that are easily bribed, they become very, very wealthy, also go to jail. And you basically try to force the smuggling to go underground. It means that it's going to be costlier for migrants to make it all the way to the Aegean. It also means that they are going to be able to bring people to the Aegean at a much, much, much lower rate. Moving people underground will probably reduce the numbers of people who make it to the coast by about 80%.
Turkey should also encourage refugees of the Syrian war to settle in Turkey, get jobs, and send their children to school. Papadimitriou says more than 200,000 Syrian children have not been able to attend school for years. He calls it a lost generation. The EU has already offered a first payment to Turkey, but how much more will these measures cost Europe?
Massive amounts of money. I, for months now, have been calling the 3 billion euro merely a down payment Frau Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, called it the first payment. But the alternative is chaos, social upheaval. If we're talking about $10 billion a year, or perhaps even more, for a period of 2 or 3 years, it's a small price to pay in order to do the right thing and the smart thing.
If those displaced by the Syrian war are not given a chance to settle in Turkey, Papadimitriou says Europe will pay a much higher price as more refugees cross the Aegean in the months to come. This is David Arnold in Washington, D.C.
As many as 3,000 migrants in the northern French port city of Calais are waiting for a judge to decide if they should be evicted from their large campsite. The decision may be made tomorrow. A group of humanitarian associations has asked that the state expulsion be postponed. Most migrants in the camp want to sneak to Britain by ferry or through the Eurotunnel rail service. In neighboring Belgium, the government has restored border controls in anticipation of a flood of evicted migrants. The French news agency says Portugal has offered to take up to 10,000 migrants from countries struggling to cope with the influx to help maintain its own population. Portugal's socialist premier António Costa last week sent letters to Austria, Greece, Italy and Sweden asking them to send migrants to Portugal. Prime Minister Viktor Orbán of Hungary today has asked the National Election Office to hold a referendum on the European Union's plan for a mandatory quota for the resettlement of migrants and refugees. Mr. Orbán says those voting to reject the proposal would be supporting Hungary's independence. Meanwhile, a German court convicted a Moroccan man for stealing a cell phone and drug possession in the New Year's Eve mob attacks at the Cologne railroad station. The 23-year-old held documents claiming he had applied for asylum in the country. He was given a suspended sentence and fined $110. The court stressed that the status and future of the man's asylum application weren't a matter for today's proceedings.
A new study finds that of the 800 peace agreements signed around the globe since 1945, fewer than 15% have addressed natural resources. The report says resources such as oil, gas, timber, and diamonds increasingly are recognized as major factors in armed conflicts. The Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit Forest Trends conducted the study. The group says the failure to reform management of natural resources in most countries could help explain why half of all peace agreements collapse within 5 years. Dr. Arthur Blundell is an expert on conflict and natural resource management and co-author of the report. He says natural resources were fueling conflict and war in Africa, and he argues that management of natural resources helps to keep peace in the country.
Given our experience monitoring UN sanctions on diamonds and timber in Liberia, we were concerned that a failure to address the role of natural resources in the war, and for the peace that matter, risks allowing the same commodities to fuel the resumption of conflict. It's a problem because not just in these countries, but half of peace agreements fail within 5 years. Many of those are conflicts that involve natural resources because the factions can use either the money or the control of the natural resources to fund resumption of the violence. In fact, conflicts that involve natural resources are twice as likely to fail within 5 years as those that don't. Given the fact that the UN's found a link with natural resources in more than 40% of conflicts since World War II, we just sort of wondered, well, how often do peace agreements even mention natural resources, much less address the governance around these resources in order to break the link in the cycle of conflict?
So do you think that in all of the cases, natural resources, they're deliberately being left out of the peace agreements?
I suspect there's probably different reasons in different cases. Part of the neglect may be strategic. Negotiators simply consider the ceasefire too fraught to deal with a complex issue that's contentious, and so they prefer to leave it to the peace-building phase. They might just be unaware of how important it is to reform how the resources are managed in order to address the grievances that underlie the conflict in the first place, or the way that the resources were used to fund and fuel the war. In other cases, I think it's a tactic where in order to get the parties to the table, you know, just to lay down the weapons in the first place, you need to entice them. And so in some cases, the negotiators use natural resources as, you know, war booty to entice the parties to the table. And then in other cases, it may be more cynical where commercial interests They don't want to hamstring the exploitation of natural resources once the war itself stops.
So how do you get countries to include natural resources in peace talks in the beginning of the peace talks?
For example, in Liberia, the UN sanctions were the leverage, I think, you know, forced through the reforms that were necessary. Not every country has that leverage. Then it's going to be more important for the rest of the participants in the peace process, the donors and other partners, to put the pressure on the factions to make sure that they really do address it. You know, we as consumers in the international community, especially with globalization, using the resources from places like Africa.
So can you explain a little bit more about what happened with Liberia?
So Liberia is a great case because it is a case of both natural resources driving the war and then the importance of getting it right during the peace process afterwards. The Liberia Truth and Reconciliation Commission documented really clearly how rebel groups fought to control areas rich in resources, either to exploit them themselves or to extort taxes from the miners and the loggers. And then they used that money to buy guns and pay fighters. In some cases, the logging companies themselves trafficked in weapons, other war material. And then President Taylor's government forced the logging companies to employ his former militia commanders as company security. And it's alleged that those militias forcibly displaced and looted and committed mass atrocities. You know, there's a really strong case to be made for the link between resources and the war, which contributed to a sense of grievance within Liberia and provided the money and material to restart the war. Because of this role that they had in fomenting the resumption of the armed conflict, the UN Security Council sanctioned the international trade in diamonds and timber. And it was interesting that they wanted to highlight the role the international community played in this. And so the sanctions were actually on the import of timber from Liberia, not the export of timber from Liberia. It was to highlight the role we had in Liberia's conflict. But then, despite all this attention within the Security Council, when the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was signed in 2003, it only mentions natural resources in terms of divvying up control among the warring parties. So one of the rebel groups was given control of the Mines Ministry and the Forestry Ministry during the transitional government. So there was nothing in the peace agreement about the necessity to reform the governance of the resources. But fortunately, the Security Council maintained the sanctions during the transition phase, and that sanctions helped provide the leverage to actually get the governance reform in place. And so then Liberia undertook a pretty intensive package of reforms that, while it hasn't been perfect, have made sure that the TRC had documented are not being done now. And so I think that it may be a large part of why Liberia has been able to avoid a return to war that affects more than half of other countries that are in a similar position. More than half of peace agreements fail within 5 years. Liberia has now been more than a decade.
I also just wanted to briefly touch on climate change and how that further impacts conflicts in the coming years and how it can be used in climate change negotiations to manage natural resources.
Climate change is going to change existing patterns of resource use as well, so that'll just potentially exacerbate conflicts. I think the link with climate change and peace negotiations is through just the international role of the international partners. And again, globalization is also changing that. We have to make sure that the international community takes seriously the governance of natural resources. And I think part of it is not looking at it as an environmental issue, but looking at it as a peace and security issue.
Dr. Arthur Blundell is an expert on conflict and natural resource management and co-author of the report. He spoke with us from New Orleans, Louisiana.
South Sudan's Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission has said that police and military officers loyal to the opposition party are expected to travel to Juba immediately. More than 1,300 opposition forces of former rebel leader Riek Machar are expected, as Machar, now first vice president, assumes office in a power-sharing transitional government. After 2 years of civil war, Machar and South Sudan President Salva Kiir signed a peace deal in August. Kiir appointed Machar as his first vice president last week in the first step towards forming the unity government. Despite the moves towards solidarity, fighting continues in parts of South Sudan. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is due in Juba tomorrow to meet with Kiir and visit a UN shelter for civilians that has been affected by the conflict.
Ankara this week joined an international working group to resolve the Libya crisis. The move follows the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan giving the green light for ministerial bilateral contacts. Since the 2013 military overthrow of Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi, Ankara suspended relations with Egypt. Dorian Jones reports.
This week, Ankara welcomed Cairo's participation in an international working group to resolve the crisis in Libya. The move followed reports Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has authorized renewing contacts with Egypt at a ministerial level. Diplomatic relations were cut after Egypt's military deposed President Mohamed Morsi, a close ally of Erdogan. Political columnist Semih Yediz of Turkey's Cumhuriyet newspaper and the Al Monitor website notes a move to repair ties with Egypt and other Middle Eastern countries follows a deterioration in Turkey's relations with all of its southern neighbors and Russia.
The isolation it has found itself in the Middle East is forcing it to try and reestablish some links that it had before.
Ankara's relations with Saudi Arabia have markedly improved under the new Saudi ruler, King Salman. The two countries are closely coordinating their support of the Syrian rebels. International relations expert Soli Özel of Istanbul's Kadir Has University says Turkey's steps toward a rapprochement with Egypt are tied to its improved relations with Saudi Arabia.
Turkey cannot increase its intimacy with Saudi Arabia and keep a very inimical relation with Egypt, which is being financed by Saudi Arabia. Remember that the common enemy for those three countries is Iran.
Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt are all concerned Iran's power in the region will grow now that international sanctions against it have been lifted. The three leaders will have a chance to meet face-to-face at the next Islamic summit set to take place in Istanbul in April. Ediz says Erdogan is aware the idea of warming up to Egypt is a sensitive subject inside the Turkish president's ruling AKP party, given the Egyptian government's treatment of supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood.
A full rapprochement at a time like this, I think, will not be received well by the ruling AKP's Islamist grassroots supporters.
But Cairo's hardline stance against Gaza is also seen as a complicating issue, given Ankara's strong backing of Gaza's Hamas government. Özel says the fate of former Egyptian President Morsi, who is facing a death sentence, is key.
If they hang Morsi, I'm sure it will be very difficult to sustain this revitalization of relations.
Analysts suggest Erdogan is pushing for commuting the death sentences against Morsi and his followers, and possibly a full amnesty for them, as the price Egypt must pay to restore diplomatic relations with Turkey. But with Ankara close to an agreement with Israel, another estranged former ally, it appears ready to compromise to end its isolation. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis and Amihis Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to African News Tonight for the latest sports, feature and more. Coming up next, right here on VOA. For the full hour of African News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis. We've got it all on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Uganda's main opposition presidential candidate, Kizza Besigye, has asked his lawyers to challenge his continued legal detention by the police. And teams of U.S. and Brazilian health workers have begun efforts to determine if the Zika virus is causing babies to be born with a birth defect affecting the brain. Coming up, music from Uganda, and in our feature segment, a training program in Liberia that provides income and employment opportunities for women. I'm Kim Lewis with Yeheya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're kicking off with European club football.
Kim, let's kick off with the UEFA Champions League, widely regarded as the best club football competition in the world. We have two first-leg round of 16 matches this evening in Ukraine and the Netherlands. In Ukraine, Dynamo Kiev will host English Premier League club Manchester City. And in the Netherlands, PSV Eindhoven is at home against Spain's Atletico Madrid. In action Tuesday, another Spanish club, defending champion Barcelona, scored a convincing 2-0 victory over Arsenal in London. Argentine star Lionel Messi, the five-time FIFA World Player of the Year, scored two second-half goals for Barca. In the 71st minute, Messi provided a clinical finish to a breakaway move that featured strike partners Neymar and Luis Suarez. And then in the 83rd minute, Messi sealed the victory with a penalty kick. With two away goals and home advantage to come, Lionel Messi and Barcelona will be confident of reaching the UEFA Champions League quarterfinals for a ninth consecutive season. The second leg will be played March 16th in Barcelona. In Tuesday's other UEFA Champions League match, played in Turin, Italy, Juventus rallied from two goals down to draw 2-2 with Germany's Bayern Munich. Thomas Müller and Iron Robin scored in the 43rd and 55th minutes for Bayern. But Juventus came back on a goal by Argentina's Paulo Dybala, his first Champions League goal, shortly after the hour mark. And then substitute Stefano Storaro got the equalizer in the 76th minute. The second leg in the Juventus-Bayern series will also be March 16th in Munich, Germany. Our African football guru, David Legg, joins us again this evening for a look at the upcoming matches in the CAF Champions League and CAF Confederation Cup club competitions.
What I've decided to do is highlight five matches in each competition. First of all, the Champions League, and I'm looking at matches where there could be upsets. And the first obvious one is Enyimba of Nigeria against Vipers of Uganda. Now, Vipers surprised Enyimba in the first match by winning 1-0 in Kampala, and 1-0 is not a nice away defeat. You'd much prefer to lose 2-1 or 3-2, and then you've got the advantage of away goals. So the tension for Enyimba is clearly the fact that they don't want to concede a goal at home. If they were to concede once the Vipers, then the Nigerian, known as the People's Elephant, they have to score three goals at least to make it through. Another factor, Sonny, that's going to cause some nerves among the Nigerian contingent is Enyimba just haven't shaped up in the last couple of years. In the last two Champions Leagues, Enyimba went out at the last 32 stage, and that's not what Nigerians expect from the club, who made history in 2003 by becoming the first club from the most populous country in Africa to win the CAF Champions League. And Enyimba, of course, went on to win it a second consecutive year. As far as the forecast goes, Sonny, I think Enyimba can scrape through. That match, incidentally, because the home ground in Aba of Enyimba is being renovated, it will be played in Port Harcourt. Another club with an identical situation to Enyimba are Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa. They played away to Chicken Inn of Zimbabwe, and Sundowns, who went into the game with a 19-match all-competitions unbeaten record, they lost 1-0. We did say on the Sunny Side of Sport that when Zimbabweans come up against South Africans at any level in football, they just seem to raise their game. They want to show their big brothers from the South what they can do. And that is exactly what happened. And Chicken Inn, they're sponsored by a fast food franchise by the name of Chicken Inn. They will come to South Africa, Sunny, in an identical frame of mind as the Vipers will go to Nigeria, thinking to themselves, if we can score a goal away from home, preferably the first goal, that really will put the pressure on our opponents, leaving Sundowns having to score three goals. But as in the case of Enyimba, one has to believe that Sundowns have got enough firepower up front to scrape through. They've got the Colombian, Leonardo Castro, who's settling in nicely. They got the Zimbabwean, Kama Biliat. He missed the first leg. And then they've also got the South African Olympic captain, Keegan Dolly. Another one to watch out for, Sonny, I think, is Maludia Bejaia of Algeria against the Ashanti Gold of Ghana. The Ghanaians won up from the first leg. Ghanaians have not done well against Algerians at club level in recent years. But to the credit of Ashanti Gold, the 1997 Champions League runners-up, they kept a clean sheet at home, and that is potentially crucial. I think Ashanti Gold could scrape through, but this one, Sonny, it's so close to call. Gamtel of Gambia. Now, Gambia is not a country you normally associate with success at the Champions League level, but they're only 2-1 behind against Olympic Kor-Ibga of Morocco, and the Gambians have got home advantage playing in Brakama, just outside Banjul. So they've certainly got a chance. A 1-0 victory for Gamtel, and they would squeeze through on the away goals rule. And finally, Sonny, to another venue we don't get a chance to talk about very often, and that's Madagascar, because their clubs generally fare very poorly in Africa. But Canaps Sport, they shocked Gor Mahia of Kenya in Nairobi, winning 2-1. So even a draw at home will be enough for the Malagasy club to go through to the second round. The Voice of America, VOA. I'm switching now, Sonny, to the CAF Confederation Cup. That's the second-tier competition. And one that I'm going to be particularly interested in is Fomboni of the Comores, because they're in with a chance of bringing the Comore Islands their first ever overall success in CAF club competitions. They're one up against Atletico Olympic of Burundi ahead of the return match in Bujumbura. Cameroon have not been doing well in African club competitions. The last success, in fact, you have to go way back to 1981 when Union Douala won the then African Cup Winners' Cup. And New Stars Douala, they're a debutant club, they lost 1-0 away to Renaissance of Chad. So they've got some catching up to do. Generation Foot, a side that won the Senegalese FA Cup when they were a third division club, they're now a second division club. They're trailing Nasarawa United of Nigeria 2-1. So that scenario that we often discuss, a 1-0 victory for the Senegalese, and they would qualify on the away goal rule. Edema of Madagascar, they're trailing Harare City of Zimbabwe by 3-2. So similar situation, Sonny. 1-0 or even a 2-1 victory for the Malagasies at home, and they would go through. And finally, we have an interesting one in East Africa. It's Bandari of Kenya up against St. Eloi Lupopo of the Democratic Republic of Congo. A tough task for the Kenyans. They lost the first match 2-0. That's a pity for them. They would, I'm sure, much prefer 3-1 or even 4-2. Because now they've got to score at least twice and make sure that those Congolese goal-mouth predators do not score at all. All told, Sonny, we've got 21 matches coming up this weekend between Friday and Sunday in the CAF Champions League and 15 on Saturday and Sunday in the CAF Confederations Cup. And the winners overall of these ties, they will go into the first round proper, which is known as the round of 32. That will be played on consecutive weekends in the middle of March.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. In Olympic news, South Africa is confident of winning a record number of medals at the Rio Games in Brazil in August. The VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman, Marco Uma, caught up with a top South African sports official and asked him about the country's Olympic chances.
South African Sports and Recreation Deputy Minister Gert Oosthuizen reckons South Africa will bag more medals in Rio de Janeiro than ever before at any Olympics and Paralympics. I caught up with him at the Best Made Road Race in the South African capital Tshwane, where he offered an insight as to why he graces this annual event.
If you look at the vision and the mission of the Department of Sport and Recreation, it's to create an active and a winning nation, to foster social cohesion. You find that sport has the power to really unite people. It's a language, you know, that transcends all barriers. This Best Made Marathon, half marathon, started 5 years ago, and we had 2,000 people that entered. Yeah, this year, we're close to 17,000 people. And if you look around, you see the Rainbow Children of Nelson Mandela participating this morning. I'm here because we are really actively supporting partnerships, private sector, institutions of excellence, creating opportunities for people to live and practice an active and healthy lifestyle, the children to play in the theme park today.
This is an Olympic year. What are your expectations from your Olympians this year?
We have high expectations because our Sports Confederation and Olympic Committee went through with the federations a very stringent selection process. We ensured that we get the athletes that are qualifying and we put them in a high-performance center and nurture them and ensure that wherever we send them, they will really be able to compete at the world stage. We have high expectations of them and of the Paralympics. We have a very strong Paralympic team. Our focus is to say we want to normalize society. Hence, this morning you would have seen people in wheelchairs participating in the marathons. You know, we have role models in that field. Ernst van Dijk is a well-known wheelchair racer. The sports movement in this country has the expectation to have a better medal count this year around than we've had in the previous Olympic Games.
That was Gert Oosthuizen, South African Deputy Minister of Sports and Recreation, speaking in Tshwane, South Africa.
Thanks, Mark. That's Mark Ouma reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. Joining us once again on the sunny side of sports is Andrew Palcheski, the Voice of America's social media reporter. Sporty greetings, Andrew.
Sporty greetings, Sonny.
Andrew, what's trending in the sports world on this Wednesday?
Well, the big trend is one name, Cristiano Ronaldo. Cristiano Ronaldo has just surpassed all other athletes in the world to have the most Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram followers of any professional athlete.
Wow.
So over 200 million combined for those three social media. So a big milestone for him. It's interesting to note that he has more combined Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram followers than LeBron James, Steph Curry, and Kobe Bryant combined. I know we talk a lot about the NBA and their social media followers there. Well, he has more than those top three players combined.
So all right, how about our friend Lionel Messi? I mentioned him at the top of the show.
Lionel Messi is about 80 million followers behind him. He's got about a little over 120 million combined. But interestingly for Lionel Messi, he doesn't have a Twitter account, at least not a personal Twitter account. There's one set up for him by his sponsor, Adidas.
Okay.
But he does not have his own. Cristiano Ronaldo does, and he has millions of followers on his Twitter account, so that may account for part of the difference there. But it certainly shows the power of soccer or football around the world. It certainly shows the power of Cristiano Ronaldo as a brand as well. It's not just his work on the field that he's showing off on his social media. It's, you know, sponsorships with menswear companies and underwear companies and all these things that he's posting these images and looking very dapper in suits and things that he's getting to promote all of these products.
Football fans love to debate the merits of Ronaldo versus Messi, but when it comes to social media, I guess you can say Ronaldo's on top.
When it comes to social media, Ronaldo is certainly, by, like I said, about 80 million ahead of his compatriot there.
Andrew, what else is trending in the sports world?
Well, we have the Montreal Canadiens. They're the hockey team out of Montreal, Canada. They recently passed 1 million Twitter followers, a great milestone for them. And how they're marking that is they had an opportunity for fans to tweet at them, and then they would get back from the Montreal Canadiens a automated message that said, thank you very much for, you know, supporting the team and helping us to get this milestone. It would feature some videos from some of the players. Well, part of the problem with this is that people would tweet at them and say some unkind things about the team, or they would use Twitter handles that perhaps used foul language, and they would get these automated messages back. So it's one of those things where they were trying to do something and be proactive on social media and trying to engage with their fans, and it kind of backfired on them, unfortunately. Interestingly, a lot of people using numbers, you know, replacing the letter I with the number one or the letter A with the at symbol to get around some of the profanity filters that they were using for this automated messaging. And that's why you unfortunately saw some of those names pop up.
And coincidentally, the Montreal Canadiens are here in Washington today. They're going to play the Washington Capitals, the NHL leading Washington Capitals this evening, right here in Washington.
Yes, and as they're preparing for that game, doing some damage control on social media, they had to tweet out and say, we apologize for some of the names that you saw. It was not our intention. But it just goes to show, like I said, when you try to engage, maybe it's better to do it person to person rather than automated engagement.
And Andrew, I encourage our Voice of America listeners to follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. And my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. Andrew Palcheski, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
And I'll see you on Friday.
See you Friday.
I'm VOA Sunny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yehias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sunny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, a training program in Liberia that provides income and employment opportunities for women. But first, the music. Here is Jose Camilion of Uganda with Jamila.
Kulia, oh, na kushinda kuongea, hata mimi mwenyewe nikaumia.
Uganda's Jose Chameleon with Jamila.
As Liberia enters its post-Ebola recovery phase, millions still suffer from the economic instability created by the epidemic, and reports show women and youths are particularly affected. Many women have resorted to selling merchandise on the street. VOA's Jackson Mvuganyi recently spoke with a local entrepreneur whose training program, Jola House, provides income and employment opportunities for women.
Reports show that across Africa, unemployment affects women and girls the hardest. In some post-conflict countries like Liberia, the economy and high levels of gender discrimination make it hard for women to find meaningful employment to support their families. Other reports show that women are often victims of intergenerational poverty, a cycle that is compounded by high rates of illiteracy. Many who lack the skills and resources have resorted to selling crafts and food on the streets. It is this entrepreneurial spirit that inspired Alfreda Mason, a social entrepreneur and designer, to create Jola House. It's a training program that helps women in Liberia gain skills to become entrepreneurs and to drive economic development in their communities.
Well, my inspiration was very simple. I left here during the coup in my late teens, and I lived in the U.S. for many years, where I have my family, my husband, and my kids. And we brought our kids home for a visit. And I just decided there was just so much devastation and so much to do. I decided that I was going to come back after my son went to school and see what I can do to help my country.
The students at Jola House are given extensive training and work opportunities to design and create items that are both functional and decorative. Most of their clothing and accessories are sold in the U.S. market.
I usually reach out to girls between 17 and 25. Most of them are mothers, single mothers. Most of them are either high school dropout or they are in high school but in low grades.
Mason says that the Jola House program gives the young women options to either work independently as designers or work together in a cooperative.
And for the first 2 years, our focus was on training and development. And after we train, we're trying to just not train and let these women go back to their homes, but wanted to train and develop some kind of enterprising. We provide the material, and then you can produce the product, and we buy the product back from you. And then that price we pay is like a living wage. Or you can go ahead and form a business. So we kind of recommend our girls to a microcredit and, you know, help them with their help them with filling up the forms, help them to have some kind of guarantee fund that when they go out there to get on their own, they will have some kind of startup funds.
Liberia's civil war ended in 2003. Its post-conflict phase was disrupted by an Ebola epidemic that killed thousands of its people. Mrs. Mason says that women are often affected at disproportionate rates, and that's why she started Jola House as a way to reduce the economic inequality of women. Alice Clements is the administrator at Jola House. She was part of the second class to graduate from the program.
Before I started working with Jola House, I had a lot of challenges. I would face a lot of difficulties. But when I met Mrs. Mason and we talked, she told me about Jola House. I had interest in Jola House when I came and got employed. I started work, and I'm so grateful to God that things are okay.
The market for Jola House products was greatly affected by the recent Ebola epidemic. The majority of her clientele were tourists and expats. They don't come as much anymore. But she hopes that with more of her products reaching the U.S. market, Jola House can increase their revenue and continue to help more women. For Voice of America, I'm Jackson Mvuganyi.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up with this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Tanzanian organizations working in the water sector joined members of the development community in Dar es Salaam in late January to mark the successful completion of the U.S. AID-funded Tanzania Integrated Water Sanitation and Hygiene, or IWASH, program, which supplied water to more than 200,000 Tanzanians and helped another 40,000 gain access to improved sanitation in schools and homes. In addition, more than 250,000 people learned about hygiene and sanitation thanks to IWASH. The program was implemented by the Global Water for Sustainability Consortium. After 6 years of working to improve the health and economic resilience of some of Tanzania's poorest rural and small-town communities, IWASH draws to a close this month. The program supports sustainable, market-driven water supply, sanitation, and hygiene services, while also supporting the sustainable management of water resources. Working with local implementing partners, IWASH has expanded access to these services in some of the least served communities in the regions of Morogoro, Njombe, and Iringa. IWASH equipped Tanzanians to consolidate these gains over time, training more than 1,000 people in water resource management and supporting 32 Tanzanian students with their postgraduate studies in water resources. The program also worked closely with the Ministry of Water and Irrigation and the Wami Ruvu Basin Water Office to improve sustainable management of water resources and watersheds. I am proud to say that the Wami Ruvu Basin benefited from the IWASH program. We now have a good base, said Praxeda Kalugendo, Wami Ruvu Basin Water Officer. We have many challenges ahead, but this program has helped us to develop tools and approaches for integrated water resource management. IWASH support allowed for the completion of an environment flow assessment and estuary studies carried out for the Wami and Ruvu rivers. The project also trained and mobilized 22 local private sector entities to carry out low-cost drilling throughout Tanzania. Access to water is essential, said Gilbert Kajuna, USAID's Tanzania Deputy Team Leader for Natural Resource Management. USAID is proud to have worked in partnership with the government of Tanzania, local NGOs, the private sector, and universities to bring productive use of water to more than 3,700 households.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Go! What's up, Africa? It's Jackson Vunganyi.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Cape Town.
Can I be upfront with you? That's exactly what Nadia and I plan to do every Wednesday at 1730 UTC. Upfront looks at issues that affect you.
Since the world is moving at a faster rate, they need to have a major computer.
Interesting news.
Canadian man was sentenced for drunk driving after being pulled over in his mother's motorized wheelchair. The 35-year-old man was fined and placed on probation.
And of course, music. No clouds in my stones. Entertainment, celebrities, you name it, we'll talk about it.
And of course, we love to hear from you. Send us your thoughts and comments. Our email address is upfront@voanews.com.
So don't forget to check us out every Wednesday at 1730 UTC on The Voice of America.